Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Weiss, Communications Director with the Center for Responsive Politics, who describes the record amounts of money that flooded the U.S. electoral system during Campaign 2000. Paul Taylor, founder and director of the Alliance for Better Campaigns, who assesses the performance of corporate media's coverage of this year's election. And John Anderson, former congressman and independent candidate for president in 1980, who discusses the institutional obstacles blocking third parties from breaking the Democratic-Republican monopoly in the U.S. political system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that poor people pushed off the welfare rolls are in desperate straits. They're more likely to be working at part-time, low-wage jobs and can easily end up homeless. This is not the pretty picture that most politicians paint of the success of welfare reform. They cheer the declining welfare rolls. But when Congress transferred responsibility of public assistance to the states in 1996, they did not mandate the states to keep track of the status of families after they were kicked out of the system. In essence, millions of poor people have disappeared. Large think tanks such as the Urban Institute and the centrist Brookings Institution have started long-range studies of what happens to people after they leave welfare, but final studies are still years away. To obtain results more quickly, the National Welfare Monitoring and Advocacy Partnership did interviews with 5,000 people using local human service agencies. They found that 65% of those surveyed were unemployed, and 28% were hungry at one point during the previous 6 months. In addition, those with jobs had trouble paying their rent. As Bob Erlenbush of the Los Angeles Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness explained, within 6 to 9 months of welfare reform, there was an explosion of women and children out on the streets. With welfare reform up for congressional reauthorization in 2002, advocates are starting to make the case that major changes are needed. Specifically, they want more support for welfare moms going to community college. Right now, the push is to get welfare recipients to work quickly, even if it means sacrificing training to obtain long-term job skills. Welfare mom Sandra Chaplin recalls her experience after she started community college in Oakland, California. She said, "I was told to drop out of college because sociology and journalism were not likely to lead to employment." After getting caught joyriding in a stolen car in Sacramento, California, Nicholas Contreras was sentenced to a boot camp, the privately run Arizona Boys Ranch. After going through intense physical drills, Contreras started to complain about nausea and diarrhea. The camp staff thought he was a faker. Contreras was punished by being forced to do extra push-ups. Over the next 2 months, the teenager suffered from a 103-degree fever, severe chest pains, and had trouble breathing. Despite complaints, the abusive treatment continued. Contreras vomited often and told the staffers his body was hurting all over. On March 2, 1998, he lost consciousness after being tossed around by camp staffers and soon died. An autopsy revealed that Contreras' abdomen was filled with over 2.5 quarts of pus. Afterwards, the teenager's uncle, Jose Contreras, remarked, "If you ask me, it was torture. That was beyond abuse. It makes your heart hurt." According to the Progressive magazine, over 100 child abuse complaints were filed against Arizona Boys Home in the last 5 years. States like California have shut down boot camp programs because they have proven to be ineffective in rehabilitating troubled youth. Other states, such as Maryland and Georgia, were forced to shake up their programs after multiple abuse cases were exposed. Former military trainer Jerome Miller, author of Search and Destroy, African American Males in the Criminal Justice System, observes, "Even the military knows that boot camp does very little for emotionally damaged youth. Remember, many of these kids have been yelled at all their lives. The dynamic between captor and captive can quickly deteriorate into serious abuse." In the belly of Wall Street, gold bars sit in cages of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank in Lower Manhattan, holding over 8,000 tons of gold bullion. This represents the standard by which currency is valued in global finance, although the real value of the stockpile has fallen off in recent years. Still, world bankers hold a great sentimental value for the gold reserves. As U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress last year, "Gold represents the ultimate form of payment in the world. Gold is always accepted." But hoarding gold by national governments can be very risky. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, gold mining is one of the most polluting industries in the United States, leaving mountains barren with deposits of toxic cyanide in depleted water reserves. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency considers pollution from gold mines on a par with the ecological threats coming from global warming and depletion of the ozone layer. Currently, the U.S. is the second largest gold producer, with most of the gold mines in Nevada. Moreover, most of the gold mining activity is not necessary. Central bankers could easily sell off the existing reserves of gold and make a huge profit. An increasing number of financial observers say it's time to get over the gold bug. The conservative Economist magazine went so far as to claim that gold reserves held by central bankers are the spent fuel of an obsolete monetary system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The year 2000 election campaign will go down in history as the most expensive in U.S. history. As of mid-October, the two major parties raised over $393 million in soft money contributions, with the Republicans outraising Democrats by more than $35 million in reports filed by the Federal Election Commission. Senate candidates raised a record $330 million, while candidates vying for seats in the House of Representatives have raised more than $525 million, according to recent financial reports. Nearly two-thirds of all House races and 40% of Senate races this year involved a candidate who has raised at least 10 times as much as his or her opponent. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen Weiss, communications director with the Center for Responsive Politics, who describes the record amounts of money which have flooded the U.S. electoral system and what large campaign donors expect in return for their contributions.
The amount of money being spent is breaking records in virtually every category. The total amount of money spent in this election will be $3 billion, which is an unbelievable amount. The amount spent in 1996 was $2.2 billion. That's a lot in and of itself, but if we reach $3 billion, that's about a 50% increase over 1996. Virtually every industry and interest group in the U.S. economy has given record amounts for their own records to candidates and parties, and money is the name of the game this time around. If you don't have a well-financed campaign, you don't have much of a chance of winning.
Now, in terms of the various sectors of the economy and the business community that are funding the two major party candidates, can you break that down for us so we know a little bit more about in whose interest they're acting?
The business community, of course, gives huge amounts of money to candidates and parties in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And they slightly favor Republicans, but for the most part, they split their contributions between Republicans and Democrats. They know the value of a good investment, and in an election, especially one like this, where you have the White House up for grabs, the House of Representatives up for grabs, maybe even the Senate up for grabs, businesses want to make sure that no matter who is elected, they, the businesses, have a friend in Congress, and that the controlling party is thankful to the business sector for what it's done in contributing to the campaign. Within the business community, there are, of course, specific areas that heavily favor Republicans over Democrats and vice versa. They're pretty obvious. The oil and gas industry is a very heavy Republican contributor. Pharmaceutical companies as well, certainly the big investor-owned electric utilities are. On the Democratic side, you've got lawyers and law firms and a few other areas as well. The most interesting thing probably is the number of businesses and industries that contribute to both sides, really down the middle. And probably the most notable one this year is the computer industry. They have increased their contributions dramatically over 1996, just as they did over 1992. And they're contributing roughly equally between the parties.
How much a part of writing the legislation are these corporate lobbyists in terms of the huge amounts of money that they're pouring into political campaigns? Do they actually get to sit in the room and help write the legislation that will benefit their own particular industry?
They come pretty close. It's interesting because lobbyists rarely have a whole lot of sway in issues that we all focus on gun control, on several environmental matters, on abortion. Members of Congress have stated their views on those issues, and the public knows what those views are. And if suddenly the member of Congress were to insert a provision counter to those views, much less make a public statement counter to those views, we'd all know about it. But what the type of scenario you're talking about is much more likely to occur with legislation that the public isn't so focused on. Tax bills, which run hundreds if not thousands of pages, banking concerns, other regulatory matters, those bills provide ample opportunity for lobbyists to enter a member's office and to say, you know, this provision would be really, really beneficial to us, and if you bury it on page 583 out of 1,026, or however many pages it is, very few people will likely find out about it. And that certainly happens on Capitol Hill, and it's up to the member of Congress to answer to the public if that type of activity is discovered.
During the primary season, we had both John McCain and Bill Bradley running against the system as it stands now with the big money and the big influence and the need for campaign finance reform. And there was a lot of hope at the outset that campaign finance reform would be a central issue in this year's election campaign, but that's not the way it turned out. Why not?
Well, you bring up an excellent point. When John McCain and Bill Bradley were involved in the election, when they were still candidates, you heard a lot of talk about campaign finance reform. And when each candidate was defeated, really John McCain, when he left the race after Super Tuesday, not a whole lot of talk about it. And you could almost sense there was a wink and a nod between Democratic and Republican leaders to say, you know, we're just not going to bring this up right now, not when we don't have to. Why? Both major parties know, and of course Al Gore and George W. Bush know, that they are beholden to the system, and that their success rests on the current system.
That was Stephen Weiss, Communications Director with the Center for Responsive Politics. Contact the center by calling area code 202-857-0044 or visit their website at www.opensecrets.org. The major broadcast and cable television networks look forward every election cycle to raking in enormous profits from political TV advertising. After the ballots are counted this year, these media companies are expected to make between $600 million to $1 billion from the sale of airtime to presidential and congressional candidates and their allies. Most Americans rely on television broadcast news for information related to candidates and issues in the months leading up to Election Day. According to recent studies, almost 50% of U.S. citizens depend on television as their primary source for election news, upon which they'll make choices in the voting booth. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Paul Taylor, founder and director of the Alliance for Better Campaigns, who assesses the performance of corporate media's coverage of the 2000 election.
What we try to do is encourage broadcasters to provide opportunities for candidates to talk about issues in the height of the campaign season, to change the current culture we have where politics on television is a nightly bombardment of campaign ads or very brief sound bites. And it seems to us that it's one of the reasons why people are so frustrated with the political system, why turnouts are so low, why campaigns are so expensive, because those ads cost a tremendous amount of money. Estimates are $1 billion this year will be spent by the political system on campaign ads. So can't we invent something new and better for politics on television? In particular, this year we have been advocating a recommendation from a panel that President Clinton appointed a few years ago to look into this issue. And this panel, which had public interest folks on it and broadcast industry leaders, recommend that every station in the country provide a minimum of 5 minutes a night of some kind of forum where candidates are discussing issues in the culminating month before every election campaign. We've been trying to persuade stations to do just that.
Now, what's been the response of stations to that specific demand?
Disappointing. We've had some response, and by our count, about 90 to 95 stations around the country are doing it. That's 95 out of about 1,300 commercial stations around the country, so it's about 7% of the industry, which is not nearly what we had hoped. The whole history of this recommendation was it was crafted as a compromise recommendation between public interest advocates who wanted it to be a mandate and the industry that said, no, you can't force us to do it. We'll do it voluntarily. So the hope was the voluntary standard would get a lot more pickup than it has.
So this gives fuel to your argument that there needs to be not just voluntary standards, but some kind of mandate, right?
Yes, and we are now making that argument. It happened that there was a hearing on this question before, at the Federal Communications Commission of when I testified and made exactly that point.
Paul Taylor, what's the breakdown of the time that the TV networks, the broadcast and cable networks are devoting to coverage of the election this year?
Oh, there have been serious cutbacks, starting with the commercial broadcasters. If you look at, if you go back to the primary election season, there were 22 televised debates during the presidential primary season, and then the broadcast networks only carry two of those, neither in prime time. Big cutbacks in coverage of the party conventions. This year, for the first time, two of the four major networks didn't cover the debates live. And if you just look at their coverage night after night and compare it to, for example, the coverage of the 1988 presidential campaign, which was the closest one in recent times to this one in that there was no incumbent running, so presumably there's a lot for the public to learn, the coverage throughout the year has been down by about a third on NBC, CBS, and ABC on their nightly news program. So politics on television has migrated away from the broadcasters and moved towards the world of cable, where not only is it a niche event, but the other problem with cable, of course, is that people have to pay for cable, 30, 40, 50, 60 bucks a month. And the whole premise of over-the-air broadcasting, the whole reason that the networks and the station owners get their airwaves free of charge, is the notion that they provide a public service. Seems to us part of the public service ought to be to provide opportunities for citizens to learn about the issues and the candidates during election time.
Paul Taylor, many of those in the news business, especially in television, they have to pay attention to the bottom line. They have to pay attention to the ratings and such. They might respond to this critique by, and I'm sure they have, by saying we're only giving the public what they want. They don't really want the hard numbers and the hard facts. They want entertainment, or I guess what's come to be known as infotainment. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would respond to that on two levels. I don't think that works as a journalistic standard nor as a public interest standard. If the idea of journalism was to, it seems to me, the best one-sentence description I've ever heard of journalism is to make what's important interesting. Political campaigns, presidential campaigns are important. The challenge is to make them interesting, and I think journalism, particularly broadcast journalism, has been running away from that challenge. But beyond that, broadcast journalism is different from all other forms of journalism in that the broadcasters do get their airwaves free of charge and do agree when they receive that license to serve the public interest. So I think they are obligated by that contract. I mean, these airwaves are literally, in this information age, these are the most valuable things we as American citizens own. They are the equivalent of the oil wells of an earlier generation. And I don't think most people realize this. They assume that at some point along the way, the ABCs and NBCs and CBS of the world have paid for these airwaves. Not true. The public gave them to them for free. Whereas in the last decade or so, we've begun auctioning off other parts of our electromagnetic spectrum to other commercial users of spectrum, such as cell phones and other things, and made tens of billions of dollars from it. So to say that, well, the public interest is what the public is interested in, seems to me is literally turning that idea upside down. In any definition, it seems to me, of the public interest, giving people the core material they need to govern themselves ought to be at the very top or very near the top of the list.
That was Paul Taylor, founder and director of the Alliance for Better Campaigns. Contact the Alliance by calling area code 202-879-6761 or visit their website at www.bettercampaigns.org. the 2000 presidential campaign, Green Party nominee Ralph Nader was accused of being a spoiler, a man leading a self-indulgent crusade who would rob the American people of a clear choice between the Democratic and Republican candidates. But throughout recent U.S. political history, third parties have had a difficult time in overcoming the institutional obstacles placed in their path. Obstacles which include arbitrary rules making it difficult for a third party to qualify and appear on state ballots, and often excludes them from candidate debates. But perhaps the biggest barriers for office seekers who have not signed on with the Democrats or Republicans is the U.S. winner-take-all system that an increasing number of observers contend robs a near majority of voters from representation in the halls of power. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John B. Anderson, former 10-term Republican congressman and independent candidate for president in 1980, who now serves as the chair of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Anderson, who received 7% of the vote when he ran for the White House, discusses the institutional obstacles frustrating third parties and reforms that could level the playing field.
Our plurality first passed the post system, which we inherited from our colonial masters, the British, has left us with a situation where the chances for a third party or independent candidate are vanishingly small. And that, in turn, plagues you with the charge of being a spoiler, that to cast a vote for you is a wasted vote, spoiling the real choice between two major party candidates. Seems to me that in a race where there are certain transcendent overriding issues, overriding in their importance, people ought to be encouraged to do exactly what they encourage their legislators, be they in the state legislature or in the Congress, to do. Vote your conscience. Do the thing that makes you feel as if you have expressed yourself in a truly democratic way in the manner that you wish, and not hang around the neck of the independent or third-party candidate the label a spoiler. But I was called that in 1980, and Mr. Nader's being called that in the year 2000. As it was, you know, in all of the post-election analyses that were done, I took as many votes from Reagan as I took away from Carter. It was the Democrats then, as it is the Democrats today, that are complaining and howling that Nader is going to spoil it for Al Gore. Even then, they were saying I was spoiling it for Jimmy Carter. The other parallel between 1980 and today is that I ended up with almost 7% of the vote, and I think it would have been double that, if not more, if I had been in all of the debates. I was only allowed to debate one time, and this time the third-party candidate, the Green Party candidate, Ralph Nader, didn't even get into one debate, let alone all three. So these are the parallels that I see. And there's nothing in the Constitution that mandates a two-party system. What has it brought us but the most expensive election in history? They say if you count all of the races, all of the expenditures in primaries and in the generals leading up to the magic day of November 7, 2000, that maybe $3 billion will have been expended. And yet something is wrong with a process that has elected the president we now have with only 43%. Of the vote in 92, only 49 and a fraction percent in the year 1996. So I think we've got to open up the process. We've got to give the American people the feeling. It not only dishonors their vote, it really makes their vote more meaningful if they have the option of voting for a third-party candidate, and he is not simply lampooned as somebody who shouldn't be in the race because he's spoiling it for the two major parties.
What, in your mind, are some of the tools and legislative and other changes we need to implement here in this country to open up the system to third parties and, as you said, other kinds of thought that depart from the middle-of-the-road ideology?
I'm so glad you asked the question because right off the bat, if we had instant runoff voting, which they used to elect a president in Ireland, which they used for years to elect the lower house of parliament in Australia, the voter is given a ballot. And on that ballot are listed the names of the candidates, and he can then rank order the candidates, one, two, three, or four, if there are four candidates running for president or more. And then you count the vote when the polls close. If no one has a majority of first place votes, you then recalculate the results with computers. This can be done in a matter of seconds. It isn't going to delay the election returns. You look at the second choice on the ballots of the candidate who received the least number of first place votes, and you assign it accordingly to the remaining candidates, and you do this until you arrive at one who has 51% or more of first or second place choices, and declare him or her the winner. The second thing we do on legislative races would be to have multiple member districts. Instead of having just one person elected for each legislative district, be it federal or state, divide the districts among several candidates. In other words, have three candidates in a district. Then obviously you could apportion the vote. And if you had a third of the votes, you'd elect one of the three. As it is today, we have many, many state legislative districts where, with our plurality system, no majority winner occurs, and the fellow with 40% wins the whole pot. And the 60% who voted for the other candidates on the ballot end up really not only not voting for a winner, but not feeling that they had any real representation as a result of the vote that they cast. If we had proportional representation, which most democracies in the world today have. So this would eliminate the spoiler charge. It would allow the voter the full range of choice that he ought to have among candidates on the ballot. It would bring out more voters. I think we'd see an explosion in voter turnout if they knew they could do that, if they had that added option. And it would just be a wonderful way of doing something to improve our present faulty, flawed, jaded electoral process.
That was John Anderson, independent candidate for president in 1980 and chair of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Contact the center by calling area code 301-270-4616 or visit their website at www.fairvote.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.